From 12 News, this is Newsmakers.
On Tuesday, Providence saw its 21st homicide of the year, the highest number of killings since 2009, and there are still 2.5 months left in the year. City violence is shaping up as a top issue in the 2022 race for mayor, and with Mayor Jorge Elorza on his way out, the issue is being hotly debated by the candidates who want to succeed him. Welcome to Newsmakers. I'm Tim White, joined by 12 News Politics editor Ted Nisi, and here to discuss that is a Providence mayoral candidate, Nirva LaFortune. She's also city council member for Ward 3 in the city. It's good to see you. Thank you for coming in.
It's good to see you both as well. Thank you for inviting me.
Let's start with city violence. In your campaign announcement, you noted that too many mothers have lost a child to gun violence in Providence. Mm-hmm. Murders and aggravated assaults with a firearm are up in 2021. Mm-hmm. What is the city getting wrong that you would fix?
So the influx of violence with guns is something that's happening throughout the nation. It's not unique to Providence. It's quite problematic. I've been with the Nonviolence Institute at the hospitals with mothers. I've visited parents who've lost their children to gun violence and family members. I lost someone over 16 years ago to gun violence. I think the question we have to ask is, what can we do more to invest in our youth, to invest in our neighborhoods? This pandemic has shown us the inequities that exist within our community. There are real disparities. Many people lost their jobs, they're desperate. We're not necessarily providing our kids with a quality education. We need to make sure that they have access to opportunities. So I think what the city should do is, one, we need to fight for stronger legislation, gun sense legislation, to make sure that the wrong people don't have access to guns. I've testified at the State House with other groups. But we also need to make sure that we're investing in our neighborhoods. We're providing job development opportunities for our youth. Our rec centers are accessible to our community. We provide our kids with a quality education. They need that so that they can have a pathway to success. Right now, our kids are struggling, and we need to make sure that they have the resources and the tools to be successful.
You know, some people at home might note, absent from your answer, is the mm-hmm. police department and increasing rank and file, mm-hmm. the numbers of the police department. Right now, mm-hmm. there are 415 sworn personnel in Providence mm-hmm. Police. Is that the right number? Is it too high? Mm-hmm. Is it too low?
Well, I just recently spoke with the chief of police, Chief Clemens, and one of the things that he said is that he would like to see the number of police go up to 450. I introduced a resolution last week asking for public safety to come up with a plan. So if we're going to use more police officers, well, how will we use them? But the most important thing is we have to implement a community policing model. Many years ago, under Barack Obama's administration, the city of Providence signed on to be a part of the community policing initiative. There is a framework there. There are strategies, a model that we can implement.
The police department never actually got rid of the community policing in Providence. And some might say the reason you're not seeing the bicycle cops mm-hmm. out there, which is always sort of the visual front of community mm-hmm. policing, and others is because the numbers are low. It sounds mm-hmm. like you heard Colonel Clements, but you're not ready to green light getting the personnel mm-hmm. up to 450 or more.
When I was elected in 2017, we had less police officers. And in my ward, I'll speak to my ward, we would see police officers on bikes. We saw foot patrol. I also had asked questions around, well, what can we do to utilize some police officers that may be used as detail to fix a pothole in our city? Do we need them there? Can we use them in other ways? And so we have to create a comprehensive public safety plan. We have to think about, with the limited resources that we have, how can we use some of our community partners like the Nonviolence Institute, who could intervene to try to prevent the violence from happening. We can partner with the communities. One of the things that I would like to do is create some sort of community ambassadors program to work with the communities to build trust. But at the end of the day, we can have more police officers in the city, but if we're going to have police officers more police officers patrolling, then we need to make sure that these police officers understand the community that they're serving, they're rooted in the community, and they're also partnering with our community entities. We have limited resources. the city has a major pension liability. So if we're going to increase the size of public safety, we have to do it in a smart way. But at the end of the day, we can't police our way out of this situation. When William Parson was shot and killed, I'll never forget that. I went to that young man's funeral. He was shot and killed on the corner of my son's school. He was at PCTA. My son was a classical student. I went to that young man's funeral, and he wrote something, and he said, to choose your friends wisely. And he was doing all the right things, and all he did was stand on a corner. And the young man who pulled the trigger, he was in some sort of limbo, waiting to be transferred to another school. When I read in an article, when they got to his house, they found all types of weapons. His mother really didn't know how to support him. So this is a kid who fell through the cracks. Could more police address that? No. It's making sure that we're investing in our young people.
You voted against the city budget this year due to its increased funding for the police department. You said in July, quote, it just seems imprudent to allocate those additional funds to the police department. Do you still feel that way after the violence this summer that we saw?
Well, the reason I said that it's imprudent is because we didn't have a comprehensive plan. So if you say that, so if someone comes to working in a company and says, well, I need more resources, the manager is going to ask, well, how are you going to use those resources? What is the plan? Do you have a strategic plan around that? And we have not yet seen a plan. So what I hope the police department or public safety can do is to create a plan. They're hiring a, they just hired a director position. Hopefully that person could play a significant role.
This is the director position that was major, then city council moved it to a civilian position.
Correct. And so hopefully that person can play a role in narrowing that gap between the community and the police. But what I would like to see is a comprehensive plan. We have to be smart. Again, we can't police our way out of this situation. Yes, we need to make sure that we're living in safe communities, in a safe city. We're making the right investments in our neighborhoods. But we also need to make sure that we understand the root cause of the problem. There's real systemic racism within our communities. We're not, again, our kids are struggling in schools. We just went through a pandemic where people experience real trauma. People are not working. People were affected by COVID. So again, we need to address the root problem, but we also need to have a comprehensive safety plan to ensure that we're allocating those resources in a smart way.
You mentioned it in one of your answers. A city pension fund is only roughly 22% funded with a liability of $1.2 billion. The mayor unsuccessfully tried to get a bond floated that would borrow up to $850 million to address it. But look, this is a perennial issue. I can't tell you how many shows Ted and I have done about the unfunded pension liability in this studio. Has addressing the city pension been a failure of the city council?
Well, addressing the city pension, it should be in collaboration with our city administrator. And also, we should bring in the state to be a part of the conversation.
What does that mean?
Well, our state legislators should be a part of the conversation in creating a plan to address the city's pension liability. At the end of the day, this is the capital city of Rhode Island. And, I mean, let's be fair. This pension liability didn't happen overnight. It took over 30 years for us to get to where we're at today. Now, in 2017, when I just started on council, I worked on the pension the pension report. I was part of the pension working group. And we outlined recommendations to try to address this real problem that's impacting our city in significant ways. And so what we need to do is implement some of those strategies to finally address this. Those strategies range from employees, municipal employees paying more into their benefits, looking at perhaps implementing a hybrid model similar to the state, growing our economic base. But we need to start implementing.
What about revisiting benefits to retirees?
Well, revisiting benefits to retirees, we can't just change the current benefits that the retirees have. I mean, there are protections around that. And at the end of the day, the retirees and the workers always have to be part of this at the center of the conversation.
If you are elected mayor, if you look out your window, you're going to see the Superman building.
Well, not out of my window. Yes, out of the mayor's
You know
office.
What I mean.
Yes.
I think over Kennedy Plaza.
Yes.
You know, there's been starting to be more talk about, is it time to consider knocking it down? There's been 10 years to look for other things to do with that building. It's decaying. Yeah. Where do you come down on that? Is that something you would contemplate, or to you, is it too important to the city as a building to allow it to be knocked down?
I remember going into the Superman building when Fleet Bank was there when I was a kid with my dad. that building is part of Providence. I do think that we can utilize the building to meet a city need, which includes housing. Maybe what can become of it is mixed-use development. We have some commercial space at the bottom, and then we have housing at top, on top. But we need to make sure that we're pushing the developer to do something with the building.
So are you frustrated with the developer, David Sweetser, at this point?
Well, I am frustrated. He hasn't done anything with the building. The city has real needs. You can't just, in the middle of the city of Providence, you have this empty building that's been sitting there for many years. So I would like for him to work with the city of Providence so that we can turn that building into something useful. And we can turn it into mixed-use development, like I said earlier. We have a major housing crisis. So let's create housing, do some inclusionary zoning, so we have mixed-income housing. Some may be subsidized. Some folks are paying full rate. But there's so much that can be done with it. We just can't leave it sitting in the middle of the city, right? I mean, looking directly right out at City Hall. So it's a waste. Actually,
for 2 years, Mayor Lorza has been implementing his Great Streets program, which is a series of bike lanes that he wants to, you know, connect the city with. The program has drawn the ire of some businesses and residents that that are along those bike lanes because they often cut into parking spaces. Mm-hmm. If you become mayor, will you continue the Great Streets program?
Well, if we want to live in a robust city, we do have to have safe in great streets. I mean, that's something that should be a part of any type of city.
Let me narrow the question to bike lanes. Would you support the expansion of bike lanes and the continued construction of bike lanes throughout the city?
So within the city of Providence, people have various mobility needs and or transit needs, and we have to have a diverse transit system. Just this past Saturday, I met a woman who's a resident at our local hospital. She just moved here with her partner from New York City. They don't own a car. They get around by bike. And one of their biggest complaints is that it's unsafe. So we need to make sure that we have options for all our residents. I mean, think about the medium income household in the city of Providence. It's about $40,000 per year. This is a small enough city where someone should not have to own a car to be connected to different types of neighborhoods. We should have a strong transit system, affordable public transportation. Folks who drive their private cars should be able to drive their cars safely, and folks who are cyclists should be able to ride down the street and not fear getting hit by a car or a bus. I ride my bike. There are times where I just solely ride my bike for a while just to get some exercise. I ride my bike with my daughter and my son when he was with me, when he wanted to come out with us. But we've ridden down North Main Street on many occasions. We have found ourselves sandwiched in between a parked car and a car that's driving down the road. We need safe streets for everyone, and we also need to have diversity in our transit system so that whoever lives in Providence could get around and could be connected to the neighborhoods.
We should disclose to viewers your son was in high school not too long ago, which is why he didn't always want to go out with you. I think you're alluding to, right?
That too.
a question about, we're talking about money. Mm-hmm. Providence sitting on over $100 million from the American Rescue Plan Act. Some of that money has been allocated already, the council in partnership with the mayor. There's a lot of different things people can imagine doing with that money. If you had to pick a number one priority for investing that money at the city level, what would it be?
Well, Ted, I'm actually the person who put in the legislation to create the task force, and I'm part of the task force as well. So we put out a survey. Over 1,000 people have filled out the survey, and the number one issue is housing. We need more affordable housing. Every year, Housing Works comes out, and they say, we need housing. If we want to grow our economic base, people need to have a place to live in. We also have seen an influx of homelessness within our city. I mean, it's economics. The supply is high. The supply is low. The demand is high.
Where do you see the most room as you look across the whole city, east side, west side, north end, to build more housing? Because people get nervous, you know, if they like how their neighborhood is now. Well, if you build too much here, will it get too dense? Where do you think there's the most, I don't know, low-hanging fruit for increasing housing supply in Providence?
To be frank, I think there's opportunities in every single neighborhood. I'm a runner, an ultra marathoner. I just wanted to throw that out there.
Humble brag.
But I get to experience the city on my two legs, on my feet. And when I run down North Main Street, in which I actually propose an idea that came in first place, I'm having community meetings. We have a firm that's working with the city to create a plan for North Main Street and build upon past plans. But I see, again, mixed-use development where we can have housing for artists, mixed-use development, as I stated earlier, inclusionary zoning, so people with different income levels can live in that neighborhood. There's opportunities there, there's opportunities on the south side, there's opportunities on the west end. We just need to make sure that we're looking at these underutilized corridors, especially corridors where there's high transit, like the R line, which is one of the most active transit lines in the city. So if you're living close to a high transit corridor, you don't necessarily need a car. You can ride public transportation, you could drive if you have your personal car, or you can ride your bike if we have accessible bike lanes. But I think the need for housing is in every single neighborhood, and we need affordable housing.
Counselor, we have to go to a break, so less than 30 seconds here, which you should do this in 5 seconds, I would say. What letter grade would you give Mayor Jorge Elorza for his performance as mayor?
You're asking an educator a letter grade?
Yeah, well, it should be easy for you, then. You've issued grades many times in the past.
I want to do a thorough assessment. It's hard being a mayor of any city. It's hard. It's not an easy
job. Sounds like you
want
to grade on a curve.
I think we should grade on a curve. You're at the Roger Williams Law School. I'm sure there are areas where, you know, they grade on a curve. It's a hard job to do. And I think there are things that he has done quite well. And there are things where he can definitely do better. But at the end of the day, I think I shouldn't be the one giving the grade. It should be the people of Providence. I'm a resident as well, but I think we all can collectively give him a grade.
All right, Providence City Councilor and candidate for mayor, Nirva LaFortune, thanks so much for joining us.
When we
come back, the executive director of the Latino Policy Institute. Stay with us. You're watching Newsmakers. Welcome back to Newsmakers. I'm Tim White alongside 12 News Politics editor Ted Nisi. Our guest for the second half is the executive director of the Latino Policy Institute, Marcela Betancur. Thank you for joining us on the program.
Thank you for having me.
We have you here because you're about to celebrate. Well, we're taping on a Thursday, and I believe the celebration is tonight,
yes,
right?
Yes, it's today. Today is the big party.
The 15th year of the Latino Policy Institute, which was founded at Roger Williams University. Look, for the people at home who don't know what LPI is or does, what do you tell them?
Yeah, no, so what I tell them is, you know, years ago, exactly 15 years ago, Latino leaders sat around a table, including today Mayor Elorza and Domingo Morel, who is a professor at Rutgers, actually. And they talked about, at that point, in 2005, the population, the Latino population in our state had already been growing. But they were seeing a lot of inequities, especially in some of their fields of education, housing, and what can we do? In the state at that point, we did not have a hub of research that said, this is what needs to happen with Latinos, this is how fast they're growing, this is their needs. And today, that's the evolution of LPI, that's where we are today. So today, we live within Roger Williams. And as part of the organization, we focus in doing research as well as advocacy and communicating the evolving experiences of Latinos. And I made sure to include that evolving piece because it's an important part to have that conversation. The Latino community, not only in our state but nationwide, is an evolving community. And we try our best to ensure that we're doing a lot of intersectionality and thought when we're doing our work.
We just got the new data from last year's census count.
Yes.
And our colleague Eli Sherman crunched the numbers and found the Hispanic population in Rhode Island grew about 40% over the last decade. I'm curious, what stood out to you in the data? Was there anything that surprised you or a new insight you hadn't seen until you saw the census numbers come out?
Yeah, so it actually surprised me nationwide. So prior to the census, we were already the largest growing community. But I think seeing the numbers grow this vastly, so now we're 19% of the population nationwide and 17% in the state. And in our state, that part didn't surprise me. I remember someone recently said that's probably an undercount even of the Latino community in our state. But what I think what surprised me the most, and part of the conversation that we need to keep having, is the Latino population nationwide and even in our state didn't grow because of migration. That is a myth that we need to kind of just put aside. Migration has kind of kept somewhat steadily in the country, but it's actually through birth, right? So I'm a first generation immigrant, but there are so many other generations that are having children, and this is thanks to that generation. Our state kept a congressional seat, and our country keeps changing.
COVID infections among Latino residents in Rhode Island are disproportionately higher than the population statewide, which you said is at about 17%, but you know, COVID infections are in the upper 20%, particularly in the community that you lived in as a teenager in Central Falls. And look, we know generally why. The Latino population tends to live in densely populated areas, and they tend to have jobs where work from home is just not really an option. Do you think the state did a good enough job protecting the Latino population during the pandemic?
I think that's a great question. I think it's a complicated question, because when I think of protecting, I think we needed protection before a pandemic happened. And so what I mean by that, you mentioned housing, right? So our families, due to income and other reasons, are forced to live in unsafe homes or homes with larger families. So that's one issue. That's how we should have been proactive. Another one is, while our state has a great percentage of insured Rhode Islanders, 24% of Latinos are uninsured. So when we talk about over 90% of Rhode Islanders have insurance, we have to look at that disaggregated data and who are those individuals who are not. And so when the pandemic happened, a lot of individuals were either uninsured or underinsured, and that impacts their prior health and the health during COVID. And so I don't think that as a state or as a society, we have focused enough in the Latino community and the important issues that have affected our life, right? Our education, our health, our economic wealth. And that is one of the many reasons why we were infected and so many of us died.
I have a terminology question for you. Gallup had an interesting poll earlier this year of, as they described it, Hispanic Americans, asking what they preferred their community to be called. Only 5% preferred the term Latinx. Mm-hmm. A little over half said Hispanic, and then the rest said Latino. Mm-hmm. We do see political leaders and sometimes activists use Latinx.
Yeah.
And I've seen some debate about this. Where do you come down on this? Is that just among elites, but in the community it's not used often? Where do you think about those three sort of ways of describing the community?
That's my favorite question to actually have, because I don't know if I've ever agreed with a group of like three or more in what term we use, even when we identify as Latino. And the reason why is language is, as you know, is in the work that you do, is evolving. Latinx is a term that it's an important, the meaning of it and the use of it is important, because we have to understand that there are non-binary individuals that identify with our Latino community. When I hear other non-Latino lawmakers or anybody else use it, I also want to know, like, do they understand why, or are they just doing it because it sounds cool? because that's not why you should do it. I think so. At the Latino Policy Institute, my first 2 months of the job, that was the decision: like, do we change our name?
Interesting. How did you decide?
And so, as with my board, which is, I have an amazing board of incredible humans, we decided, again, language is evolving. And when it comes to a Spanish-speaking language, Latinx is actually it's a difficult, like, the X is a weird sound. Latinx, it wouldn't make a lot of sound. So Latino sounds better to us in our Spanish language. And yes, we have a gendered language, unlike English. But I think there's, to us as a Latino Policy Institute, it's deeper to that, because yes, we have to acknowledge that there are difference in binary and gender. Nevertheless, how are we acknowledging that with our work? So when other individuals who may not be Latino ask me that question, I say, when you walk into a room, you have to respect the room. if you, this is not your identity, you have to respect it. And whatever term you're using, you should do that yourself. Don't use the term Latinx just to sound extra cool or like you're in. Respect the room, and that's the term that I think you should use.
Quick here, we have a little over a minute left. President Trump did well with the Latino population. Mm-hmm. Central Falls, which has the largest Hispanic population in the state, saw the biggest swing toward Trump in 2020 compared to 2016. Why do you think?
Because I think this is again the evolving experience of Latinos. All Latinos are not Democrats. All Latinos don't care about immigration. All Latinos don't care about social issues. In Latin America, where we're from, a lot of people actually can identify with more conservative ideologies. And that is something that I don't think this country has completely grasped. And so that was not surprising. Mm. It's sad to hear because of the many things that he has done towards our communities and other historically underserved communities, but it's not surprising. And it should not be surprising for this country because we've been voting Republican since like decades.
Very briefly, like we have like 20 seconds left. Do you think the Democrats have taken the Latino vote too much for granted,
yes,
thinking it's just going to be theirs?
Absolutely. Oh my God. Yes, yes, yes. All of them.
So yes.
Yes. Yes.
So a bit of a warning maybe to the candidates next year in Rhode Island too.
Absolutely. Yeah. Also, don't go to Latino communities only when you're running for office because we know and it's so obvious.
That was interesting. Well, listen, Marcela Betancourt, Executive Director of the Latino Policy Institute, again, congratulations
Thank
on the 15
you.
Years. Have a great time tonight at the celebration, and we'll have you back in, say, 15 years
yes.
from now. Does that work for you?
That works.
Okay.
Perfect.
Very
I'll put
good.
It in the calendar.
All right. Thank you for watching. If you missed any of it, it's on WPRI.com. For Ted Nisi, I'm Tim White. We'll see you next week on Newsmakers.